Welcome to Voices of the Valley, a series interviewing growers, entrepreneurs, educators, and technologists who are inventing new solutions for today's and tomorrow's challenges on the farm. Brought to you by Reedley College, educating the next generation of agriculturalists in advanced technology, efficient production practices, and food safety. Now here's your hosts of Voices of the Valley, Dennis Donahue and Candace Wilson.
This is Dennis Donahue, and welcome back to another episode of Voices of the Valley. We've got a very interesting guest today, Candace, and so welcome to you. Good to see you.
Always a pleasure, Dennis. How are you today?
I'm doing all right. And this is going to be an interesting conversation because I think we're going to kind of span the world a little bit. Our guest is David Magana, who's the Vice President and Senior Analyst of Rabo Research in North America for Fresh Fruits, Vegetables, and Nuts. David, did I get that or pretty close?
That was exactly right, Dennis. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to share a few points of discussion with you.
Well, I don't get exactly right too often, so we'll take it and get started with theirs. So with that big title and knowing Rabo's a global player, talk a little bit about your background and then just your kind of your career path to getting to your current responsibilities, and then we'll kind of dig into that.
I'm part of a large global group of more than 80 analysts that Rabo Bank has. And we are organized in different groups for our teams, specializing in different segments of the food value chain, going from farm inputs all the way to consumer foods and everything in between. So I have some colleagues that cover dairy or animal protein, as I said, consumer foods, supply chain, grains and oilseeds, and I'm part of the global group that covers fresh fruits, vegetables, and tree nuts. And I'm responsible for covering that for the North America region. And as far as my background, I grew up in a rural community in central Mexico. So I've been involved in ag all my life. And then I went to an ag school in Mexico, got a degree in agribusiness, then got a couple of graduate degrees from Texas A&M University on ag economics. And I've been doing this type of applied economic research on agribusiness for the past 20 years. And the five past years, I've been with Rabo based in Central California.
Well, that sounds good. Normally, when we think about Aggies around here, we're thinking about UC Davis, but this is the Texas version. So delighted to visit with you.
I'm an Aggie, though.
Yeah, nope, you're an Aggie. And we're not going to split. I will not get in the middle of Texas A&M versus UC Davis, other than we like all the Aggies. And but covering fresh fruits, vegetables, and nuts, I mean, that's a fastball down the middle for Western growers. So we're looking forward to the conversation. Talk a little bit about, I guess this is the way I'd kind of phrase it, talk about the importance of your work, you know, because you've really got that. You know, when you go through your reports and that type of thing, you know, you really have that global view of things. And just, you know, Western growers, members have been exporting for a long time. And obviously, if you're competing in the North American market, you're familiar with imports. So it's certainly a global game, but it seems like more and more so that certainly our members have got to be thinking about the world at large.
Absolutely. And that's one of many aspects that make Rabobank unique, is this global group of analysts. And for example, I have colleagues that cover fresh produce that sit in South America, in Australia, in Europe, and also here in the States. And that allows us to have this global view and provide our clients and the industry as a whole with this unique analysis, having this global reach. So we provide insights, analysis, not only within the bank, but also to our clients. So we have internal clients such as credit, risk, and also our relationship managers. And also we speak at different industry events and provide and also publish reports. So probably the most relevant part of this job is to provide this objective point of view regarding where we see opportunities and where we see some of the challenges for the industry and some opportunities to overcome those. So having said that, I think try to keep an objective point of view is a relevant aspect of this job.
And I'm curious, how do you, I know that you will be publishing several new reports coming out very soon. How did you choose what you were going to do your research on? There's so much going on in the industry, but you honed in on a couple different topics. How did you narrow those down?
Well, we got several ideas from clients, from bankers, and also we have our own research agenda. For example, I published market updates for several commodities, given the most economically relevant for the region. So I typically try to cover on a yearly basis some reports on, for example, berries, tree nuts, almonds, pistachios, and also table grapes and things like that. And also we have another type of research that is more like topical research, where we try to combine or analyze different trends, different topics that are impacting the industry as a whole, such as a new report that we just published a couple of weeks ago, covering the supply side and export outlook for fresh fruits and tree nuts in the U.S.
One of the things I'm always struck by when you have a gathering is you seem to do a pretty good job of getting kind of the executive crowd, which is really, really important. I get a very strong sense that people really do very much rely on these types of reports to help them guide their decision making.
Yeah, and we try to get the big picture and also some specifics. So having colleagues also covering farm inputs and supply chain also help us to have a global view of what's happening, not only in the industry, but all the different factors that impact the way we do business in this specific industry. So having this synergy with my colleagues and being exposed also to visit farm operations across the Americas, that provide us with a good opportunity to be exposed to what's been happening, what's relevant to decision makers and to the industry overall.
Well, one of the things I was struck by with your global outlook, and you talked about the different factors, and they range from water, land, logistics, inflation, so on. But ultimately, you summarize, and it sure got my attention, a massive collision of forces. And I'm just curious, is that a phrase you routinely use, or is that this moment in time in particular?
Probably over the past 2 to 3 years, we've been hearing this term unprecedented times, probably too often, right? Like there is always something new in the industry. There is always challenges. There is always opportunities. But over the past 3 years, and even before that, we've been seeing this massive collision between demand side forces and supply side forces. And I always like to make this analogy in terms, for example, if you like to go hunting, and particularly if you like to go either black swan or gray rhino hunting, you're in luck because those have been in season for a while. And let me explain what I mean by that. And that doesn't mean specifically going to be swan hunting, because I know that's illegal. But the black swan is a term that refers to an unpredictable event that is beyond what is normally expected of a situation, and that's potentially severe consequences. So examples of those are 9/11, the global financial crisis of 2008-2009, the 2014 oil crisis, Brexit, and things like that. So you get the idea. Also, the gray rhino is a probable event with a great deal of impact, which is typically ignored, neglected, or minimized, right? And examples of these are geopolitics, monetary policy of central banks. You know that interest rates are going to go up, but you decide to minimize or just like, hey, I'll do something later, probably. And also the adoption of new technologies. So having said that, we've seen a combination of a lot of gray rhinos, if you wish, or even probably, I don't know, if we've seen a black swan over the past 3 years. Some people consider the pandemic being a black swan, but I mean, we've had pandemics before. But definitely the combination of factors over the past few years has been exceptional. Or like people like to be saying, we've been facing unprecedented situations. And that has to do, as I said, with supply side dynamics, which are we're facing land constraints, water constraints, regulatory constraints, not to mention labor constraints that have been a challenge for years in agriculture. And as of the past couple of years, also logistical constraints. So these constraints collide with demand side factors such as increasing population, increasing middle class population, particularly in Asia, that are demanding not only more food, but different type of food, particularly more protein, and consumers also in developed markets that have high expectations and are demanding taste, convenience, and healthfulness. And having said that, we have some consumers that are now demanding these seemingly contradictory desires. Let's put it that way. On the one hand, they want fresh produce being available year-round, but they want it to be locally grown, even when that is not always possible, right? They want it to be perfect quality, but at the same time, they want it to be organic and use less pesticides. And also, we want more convenience, but at the same time, we want less use of plastic and less plastic being tossed into the ocean, right? So for agribusiness now, like the industry will have to be facing those seemingly contradictory desires from consumers and at the same time be providing enough food and also affordable food. So that's been some massive collision that has been in place for years. And on top of that, you include the pandemic, the war in Europe that continue to have ripple effects. Now we're facing with a unique set of challenges that will continue to drive opportunities and change in the industry.
In regards to these collisions, and you highlighted those so beautifully, some of them have been around for a long time, and some of them seem to be gaining some steam. But do you have any ideas about, like, as you're talking to your clients, how are we approaching those collisions? What kind of solutions need to happen, or education? What conversations need to take place?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. As I said, we've been facing these formidable challenges. And if we just recall, go back for a moment, just 200 years ago, a famously pessimistic economist, Thomas Malthus, he was mentioning that humanity was doomed to destruction because population was growing faster than we were able to produce enough food, right? So he was proposing very drastic measures, including, well, we don't want to go into detail, but all the point is something that he was not considering was innovation and obviously how technology is being transforming the industry. So for hundreds of years, innovation has always been the answer. But now, granted, the equation is now more complicated. Given all the constraints that I mentioned about labor, land, water, regulatory constraints, now we have also in the toolkit a lot of new innovations in terms of automation, robotics, mechatronics, information technology, genetics, things like that. And on the genetic side, I just want to mention one aspect that has been quite interesting, that is gene editing. And that has the potential to continue to transform the industry in a good way. Obviously, there are some risks associated with that and some regulatory aspects that are also limiting the adoption of this technology. For example, in the EU, by next month, that's June 2023, they will be discussing how they will be adapting the regulation regarding gene editing, because at this point, their definition of gene editing is genetic modification, right? So a gene-edited product is GMO, and they are likely to transition from that position So this gene editing has the possibility to overcome some of the challenges, for example, creating some crops that are drought resistant or disease resistant, and definitely create the possibility to produce more food with less inputs, which is going to be critical.
I love that. You're talking to a very pro gene editing gal. So
all right.
I'm really looking forward to hearing how the EU conversations unfold. Dennis, unless you have something to piggyback right there, I'm curious, can we transition into some of the major learnings or outcomes from the tree nut analysis that you guys did? Is there anything there that really stood out to you, maybe caught you guys by surprise, or what can we share with some of the growers that are listening?
Let's put it this way. 2022, the tree nut industry went through a perfect storm, given the combination of an exceptional drought in California, low yields due to deficit irrigation, salinity buildup, things like that, elevated cost of not only water, but a lot of inputs, including fertilizer and other chemistry. And on top of that, we had prices being pressured by record levels of inventory. So in short, high cost, low prices, low yields, and also a very strong dollar against key currencies in markets such as the EU and some Asian markets, that really put under pressure the margins, prices, things like that. But over the past few months, we've been observing that many of these supply side factors have been moving in the right direction. Particularly, logistics have been improving. Also, on-time arrivals have been steadily improving as well. So starting from January 2023 and in the past few months, we've seen strong tree nut exports, which is now improving the price outlook. And also on the supply side, definitely fertilizer costs have come down from very limited levels in 2022. Water situation in California has definitely changed for the better. So we're definitely seeing some of these factors moving in the right direction. And in terms of prices, price outlook has been also improving.
Well, that's a nice story and a nice evolving story. Let's keep our fingers crossed.
It is an evolving story. Now the challenge is in terms of yields, given the very challenging pollination season, we will see a particularly heterogeneous yield story across the valley. So in some areas where they have decent pollination, they will have good yields. And in some other areas, they will be having way below average yields. So we will be hearing a lot of divergent stories in the next few months. And this debate about how the size of the 2023 crop, particularly for almonds, will continue the rest of 2023. So because now we start to hear some of these new estimates and they are all over the place. So there is no consensus on that, given the very challenging pollination season that we observed. So,
question for you, particularly on the almond or the nut side. You know, obviously California has been a big global player in the almond industry. And then just kind of listening to what you just said, obviously the restoration of business basics have allowed some growth and getting back to doing business. But is there going to continue to be global pressure of new regions coming online to compete with California from an export standpoint? Or should California still, obviously, you know, given kind of what I understand, an 80%+ market share globally, you know, the bottom doesn't fall out overnight, but what kind of global pressure should the almond players in California expect?
So yeah, California will continue in the next few years to have that share, 80% of global almond production. Some of the regions that follow second distant place is Australia, which they just announced that their crop is going to be 25% below previous expectations. And also another growing region that is relevant is the EU, particularly Spain, but they've been facing some drought challenges as well. So seems like global almond production will be down significantly in 2023. and California should keep a similar proportion of that global production.
Well, and it sounds like, so for instance, you know, your avocado report, and I, you know, we're getting ready for a big global summit on biologicals, and we're working closely with somebody in New Zealand, and who knew there was actually a World Congress of avocados that recently took place in New Zealand. And it's interesting, you know, if you think about the three reports we had a chance to review along with your global outlook, avocados, berries, and tree fruit. I mean, those are top 10 items and just in terms of California in general. So obviously those are critical commodities to be taking a look at. It sounds like the avocado industry, you know, the U.S. is obviously a big importer, but, you know, the nature of that fruit is such that the U.S. is also the target, and another, in order for there to really be market expansion, there's going to have to be more education of consumers and teaching about the fruit and that sort of thing. The avocado industry, besides other growing regions, it sounds like they've also got to, they're going to have to dig in their heels a little bit on creating more demand, if I read your report correctly.
Well, yeah. I mean, just 2-3 years ago, I was discussing these trends in terms of availability of avocados in the U.S., and that was surprising to many people, how fast this availability of avocados in the U.S. has been expanding. And let's put just a couple of numbers. In 2012, per capita availability of avocado in the U.S. was about 5 pounds per person per year, whereas last year, it was close to 9 pounds. And a couple of years ago, I published a report saying that we're expecting before 2030, this per capita availability to surpass 11 pounds in the U.S. So some transformation in the industry, definitely. The U.S. continues to be the main destination market for avocados, particularly coming from Mexico. And now you see a distant second place in terms of exporting country, which is Peru. And Peru, you know, is the now a powerhouse in terms of fruit exports. They have become the largest exporters of blueberries over the past 3 years. Now this season, they will be, or they already are, they concluded their season already, the largest exporter of table grapes, surpassing Chile, in terms of both value and volume. But in terms of avocados, they have the second place, and they will, in the foreseeable future, they will be in that place because, I mean, Mexico is just massive in terms of avocado production, but things have been shifting. Let's put it this way. Just a year ago, the only state in Mexico that was certified to export avocados to the U.S. was Michoacán. And they produce from 75 to 80% of the national avocado production. And the second place is the state of Jalisco, and they produce a little bit more than 10% of Mexican avocado production. El Jalisco is also eligible to export to the U.S. market. So now you will see that some of these marketers, now they have an option to either be buying avocados from Michoacán or from Jalisco. And also you have avocados coming from Peru and the local production coming from California, which in this year was delayed a little bit. So we will see California avocados ramping up as we speak, and we will see some availability of avocados all the way until the end of the summer. So I always say at this point, we are expecting steady supplies for this year, which should continue to have prices at affordable level, which is now a very good option for consumers that like or love avocados in this inflationary environment. So now avocados at the wholesale level are half of the price as it was just a year ago, given this condition. So in the next few years, we're expecting some growing areas to diversify. We will see some more avocados coming from Colombia, from other regions in Europe. But definitely the market is being growing globally. So now Europe is also absorbing more avocados, particularly those coming from Africa, South Africa, Kenya. And in Asian markets, I mean, there is a lot of untapped potential for avocados. So. overall, it's a great product. We have identified over the years, obviously, some demand drivers are healthfulness, convenience, taste, and definitely avocados tick those boxes really well.
I have a question. Can you clarify the measurement that you mentioned around availability per capita? And how's that different than consumption per capita? What's the difference there?
Well, if we get into specifics, there is always a debate on how much is demand, how much is consumption, and how much is availability. So the demand is the basic economics 101 definition is how much, what's the quantity that consumers will be willing to buy given price level, right? And also we have consumption, but availability is more like you have production plus imports minus exports, and you just ignore all that goes to waste.
Okay, so it's the number that should I choose to consume 9 pounds per year of avocado, that is available to me. Every human being has access to 9 pounds in the U.S.
On average, yes.
On average, yes. Well, yeah, I take up at least two or three of those. So
yeah, which is, for some, is quite high, given that just 10 years ago, it was about 5 pounds per person per year. But when you consider per capita availability, or if you wish, per capita consumption, which is like, if we make the assumption that those are mean the same, in Mexico is about 20 pounds. Okay. And by the way, I grew up in Michoacán and I grew up eating avocados in the 80s. And yes, we eat a lot of avocados.
You do. I have many friends in Mexico, and it is amazing to me the amount of avocados that are consumed. And I didn't realize there were only some states in Mexico that have, you know, permission to be exporting to the U.S.
Yes. How come? Only two. That's in terms of sanitary certifications.
Okay.
Right? Because Mexican avocados were banned in the U.S. for most of the 20th century, from the 1910s until 1997. And then the U.S. started to allow Mexican avocados to enter the U.S. market for some regions, some states, and so for some period of time. So they started relaxing that restriction from 1997 for about 10 years. And since then, Mexican avocados from Michoacán had unrestricted access to the U.S. market. And starting in the summer 2022, also avocados coming from the state of Jalisco are allowed into the U.S. market. The rest of the avocados are either consumed in the domestic Mexican market or exported to Canada, Japan, or Europe.
Okay.
Talk a little bit about your berry report. I mean, one of the things I was really struck by the berries was, you know, if you go through avocados or fresh fruits or, you know, fruits and nuts, you know, the words global, competitive, I mean, they're right in the mix. And so, for instance, from a domestic production standpoint, you know, and you talked about it's going to be important to be more efficient and, you're going to have to compete to get your share, you know, even though Candace can now eat 9 pounds a year instead of five. But strawberries seem to have a little more of a general tone of, I'm not sure optimism is the right word, but it just seemed like there was just going to be continuing growth. And I was struck by, you know, that was the only report that, and kids like them. I'm sure that kind of helps the category move along. I mean, the weather's obviously the big variable in strawberries, but there just seemed to be a little more tone of optimism around strawberries in general that they're going to continue to grow.
Yes. And for example, before all these atmospheric rivers hit California and impacted and delayed some of the plantings and delayed some of the harvesting, which is still, we've seen that strawberry harvesting in Salinas, Watsonville, it's been delayed by 2-3 weeks, but now it's ramping up and it's been more than compensated by the extension of the season from Oxnard. Having said that, before all that, according to the California Strawberry Commission report, they were estimating that plantings for production for this time of the year reached multi-year highs, given that now the industry is trying to keep up with expanding demand in the US. So if you look at the numbers, the strawberry consumption, again, per capita availability of strawberries is around 7 pounds per person per year in the US, which surpasses all the other berries combined. The closest berry in terms of volume that is available in the US is blueberries, which is almost 3 pounds per person per year. And raspberries and blackberries are below that level. However, we've seen that availability of raspberries, blueberries, and blackberries has been increasing rapidly over the past decade. If you look at raspberries, they've been growing about 14% annual growth rate for the past decade. And also very rapid expansion in blueberries and blackberries as well. So I think the strawberry industry has been benefiting also from the year-round availability and given good quality also for other berries. One study that is interesting is to see if all these berries are actually substitutes among each other or they are complements, which seems like in many cases, those are complements because now you see the berry category in the fruit aisle expanding. And now with any day of the week or any week of the year that you go to the supermarket, you will see fresh quality berries, which has been creating the demand for consumers that just 2-3 decades ago, we didn't have year-round availability of all berries. So one factor again, powerful combination of healthfulness, convenience, and taste helping this. As kids, they want to be eating something that is tasty. And mothers, they want the kids to eat something that is healthy. So in this case, there is no compromise. Everyone is happy.
That's so beautifully put. It's so true. And I want to make sure. So what you're saying is that blueberries don't take a hit because strawberries are the favorite. The entire category seems to be raising together as all of those attributes improve, like you say.
That's what we've been observing over the past decade or so. All the berry category, it's been expanding in terms of per capita availability in the US market. Obviously, you have seasonality, you have increased exports, but for most of the berries, strawberries, raspberries, and blackberries is mostly a regional market, mostly grown in the Central Coast in California for most of the year and imported from Mexico during the US off-season, whereas blueberries is a total different story. It's more like a global market, imports coming from Peru, from Chile, from different places. But overall, it's an exciting industry and will continue to grow in the next few years.
Can I, Dennis, I know I'm kind of being a conversation hog, so you just give me the signal.
No. Do your thing.
Okay. You want to know what I want? This is for all the people out there, the plant breeders out there, the gene editing people. So I would like a strawberry that is kind of small. Think about like a cherub tomato. Without the little, what's the attachment thing card again? Like calyx maybe? I don't know. I can't remember. But there's the green part with all the leaves and the stem. I don't want that. I just want a little thing of, I'm going to call it like strawberries, like cherubs. Grab it, put it in the fridge, set it on the counter, and my kids can pop it in like blueberries or raspberries. Yeah. You think somebody can do that?
I don't know, but I've been hearing, for example, some projects of having seedless blackberries. So
yes, there you go.
Something like that. And also in terms of this gene editing is improving the flavor of kale, given that it's such a nutritious item, but the flavor is probably not the favorite for some people. So they're also working on this gene editing for the flavor. And I know they're working also on improving the nutritional content of spinach and other leafy green aspects. So excited to see in the next few years some of these innovations coming to the market.
All right. Well, Driscoll, here's the thing. Quick release, okay? At harvest, just the little stem, the berry detaches from the stem. Well,
Candace, you know, I expect you to stay on point, but you do have a chance to moderate a conversation with Driscoll's global executive VP of research at our biological summit. So if he's listening, he's been forewarned. That one's coming.
I have a dream. It's
there
true.
You go. David, I want to go back to your, you know, as we begin to wrap up, I want to go back to your, I don't know why I'm so obsessed with your massive collision slide. I just, you know, I think it just frames a lot of stuff. So put on your consulting hat for a moment and, you know, knowing that we think a lot about Western growers and our members and fresh fruits, vegetables, and nuts, and think to that slide, you know, all the different elements, regulatory, water, you know, if you were to say, okay, look, we've put out this report, some of this stuff, things are settling down a little bit, you know, input costs, inflation, that's going to go through whatever it's going to go through. But if you had a few of these folks around the table go, let me tell you what I'd really be concerned about if I were a Western Growers member and that, you know, you're a producer and you got to compete in this global market, what would you tell people to really kind of lean in on and pay attention to?
Well, that's a million-dollar question. If I want to put my consultant hat on, does that include my paycheck? That was supposed to be funny, not too funny. But
Well, no. It's just you're going to have to take it up with the Bravo powers that be. So hopefully our voice carries to the Netherlands. So we'll see if we can help the cause. But in the meantime, put your consultant hat on.
Yeah, I know that as we started this conversation with a lot of different constraints, and every year is different. Growing up as a farmer, you know that. But definitely continue adaptation and innovation will have to take place. I know that, for example, labor will continue to be a challenge. So now there are new efforts to make the available labor more efficient. And also, it's a whole different game that we will see in the next few years with all these different forces impacting the way we grow our food. And that's probably not the answer you were looking for, but I mean, there's a lot of different areas of opportunity. Now we've seen with all these impacts from the atmospheric rivers, we've seen that they've been trying to expand the growing season in some other areas. So this diversification would also be key, a diversification of growing seasons, growing regions, I mean. And we'll have to be adapting to new growing conditions. And at this point, for example, one aspect is vertical farming continues to develop and still quite challenging on the technical part and the profitability part. But that will be a reality in the next few years. And we will see a lot of different efforts in terms of, as we discussed, gene editing and how to provide the consumers with a good quality product year round, and at the same time that is sustainable, and I mean sustainable in the full meaning of the word, which is has to be sustainable from planet, people, and profit, right? So it should be a lot of different aspects where, depending on the crop as well, I see quite a bit of opportunities arising in the industry.
You know, there was no right answer. I was just kind of curious what occurred to you. It seems to me the real, and you know, my favorite ag phrase is, it depends. And so it might depend on the commodity or the weather. And I'm glad you brought up labor, because I'm not sure people fully appreciate this labor discussion as a global conversation in terms of the ability to get sufficient labor, which is going to drive things like automation. But, you know, it seems to me in many respects, the real wild card more and more is the regulatory side of things. You know, I kind of think back to, you know, when food safety shifted from a department to a boardroom consideration, you know, when the E. coli deal broke out in 2006. And, you know, food more and more is just at the intersection of everybody's agenda. So the regulatory piece seems to me to be a real key on a go-forward basis. And obviously, you alluded to gene editing and that type of thing. So that just strikes me as a real wild card and not always as predictable as we'd like.
Yeah, and also regulation and even policy reforms don't always will be able to solve underlying trends. For example, I can mention on the labor situation, even immigration policy reform will not change the demographic changes. And for example, one aspect is natality rate. And I know it's no secret to anyone that California Act, particularly some sectors, have been relying heavily on migrant workers coming from Mexico for the past few decades. And we've seen drastic changes, for example, in the availability of workers. Just one factor keep it up is the natality rate. Just in the 70s, the average family in Mexico was close to 7 children per family. Nowadays, it's closer to 2. So we will never have the same availability of workers that we had in the 80s and or the 90s, right? And now, given this diversification of growing regions to be able to provide consumers with year-round fresh fruit, for example, some of these companies have been now expanding into central Mexico, particularly to grow berries and vegetables and just to keep it general. So now all these workers that used to migrate from Mexico to the U.S., now they have options to work closer to home and without having to come to the U.S. So just as a fact, like after the Great Recession of 2008-2009, the decade after that, the net migration from Mexico to the U.S. was actually negative. And we've been feeling that in terms of lack of availability of workers. But now, to your point, this is more like a global trend, which is impacting not only ag operators in the U.S., in California, but even in Mexico. Many of the ag operators, they say that labor is one of their main challenges. And we've been hearing that, we've been seeing that also in many places in Europe as well. So that's a global aspect. And again, innovation in that term to make the available labor more efficient will be key.
Sounds good. Well, Candace, any final thoughts as we kind of wrap up?
I have a final thought.
Okay.
Have you guys reading about artificial intelligence and all the progress? So here we started with innovation. Let's conclude with robots and artificial intelligence. And the sooner I can get one to unload the dishwasher, the better. Okay.
There you go.
On a serious note, I don't have anything else. This has been such a great conversation. And thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, and if they can do it, unload a dishwasher, then that means that we're right around the corner of being able to harvest a strawberry and all of the other great crops that our members are involved in. David, any final thoughts from you? And we've sure enjoyed kind of the global perspective on all of this.
All right. If you had that robot unloading your dishwasher, can you bring me a robot that can fix me a nice cocktail?
Yes, perfect. That sounds great.
That sounds like the basis of another episode, or it means this one ought to come to an end. So Candace, why don't you take us home?
All right. I hope all the Voices of the Valley listeners have enjoyed the conversation today. And thank you so much for being on this journey with us. Please be sure to both like and subscribe to Voices of the Valley. And we'll be back again next week.
Thanks for listening to the Voices of the Valley podcast, brought to you today by Reedley College. To learn more about Reedley College's Agriculture and Natural Resources program and the courses offered in Ag Technology, Food Safety, and Plant Science, you can visit reedleycollege.edu.